Well, hello and welcome. How's everyone doing, besides being hot? Hot but full. My name is Kata Schwein, and I teach at St. Olaf College. I teach creative writing and composition. My sort of specialty and my training is in poetry, but more the writing of it and the teaching of how to write it than specialization in a certain time period or context. And so today we're going to I'll give you a little bit of sort of context stuff for some of these poems, but really our attention will be on the poem itself. And so if anybody else is an expert in a certain period or has more contextual insight to offer, please feel free to jump in, because that is not my area of expertise. I always begin these sorts of discussions, I mean, most people who have been to a Holden session sort of know this, but I mean, the reason that I love teaching at Holden is in part because I always get to bring up new things and have new discussions with people about poems that I don't feel like I completely know by any means at all. So this is very much a no specific right answer kind of discussion and a give and take kind of discussion as well. It won't be as much lecture based as it will be everyone sort of feeding in with different observations and things like that. So please feel free to speak up. We need to hear all voices for it to be a good discussion. I think that's everything before we get started, unless anybody has any initial questions. Good? Okay. The sessions this week focus on poems that deal with nature in some way. And obviously, poetry has a long tradition of dealing with nature in some way. Poets have to wrestle with nature either in the poems themselves, or they're dealing with it by avoiding talking about it, which is a whole other category of a poet's relationship to nature. We're going to look at poems that deal with nature a little bit more directly, and partly because I'm sort of interested, and I hope you will be too, in the way in which poets view nature, or talk about nature, or encounter animals, how their perceptions shape sort of their reality, and the way they ultimately, or we ultimately, might treat nature. So if we see the sun as a good and beautiful thing who brings us blessings, versus if we see the sun as a star that creates a certain amount of gas and has these certain, right, like these different views of what nature is and how it relates to us can also affect, you know, as we make laws, as we go on hikes and decide what to leave behind or step on, you know, like how are our own perceptions, our own ways of being in nature, how do they affect us? Does that kind of make sense? And obviously the poets, to a certain extent, can be speaking from a specific context or time period where a certain view of nature was, you know, just the way things were. So there's some of that in there too. And that's why I wanted to start out with, there's lots of different poetic movements, time periods, all sorts of things. But I wanted to give you three that I just think are sort of important to have an idea about. One is the metaphysical poets. So this was early 1600s, and tomorrow we'll deal with George Herbert, who was a metaphysical poet. Metaphysical poetry, philosophical and spiritual subjects were approached in a rational sort of way. And so poetry was sort of more used as a means towards coming to some sort of understanding about something. So as we'll look at in the poem tomorrow, it's called The Flower, but it's really about a much larger abstract idea. And so Herbert's sort of wrestling with this idea through the use of the flower. Like the flower's own cycle and development becomes part of understanding himself. And so a lot of use of extended metaphors, like I don't know if anybody remembers the Flea, which is a rather famous poem that we have. Anyway, that's a good example of this. Anyway, So a lot of use of extended metaphors, which would also be called a conceit. So that nature is more used as metaphor than anything else. And we can talk about, part of what I want to get at ultimately is that a good way to understand nature or a bad way? Can that be harmful? Okay, so a second period, the Romantic period, late 1700s, and we'll look at Wordsworth later this week. Whitman is also in this category, lots of people, Coleridge. And the Romantics, huge sort of reverence for the natural world, bordering on a sort of intense idealism sometimes. Certainly a lot of passion. They sort of come out of an opposition to order and rationality, although I was just reading in the New York Times Book Review yesterday a book that came out that recently that talks about the Romantics' passion for science, too, and that that was something that they really cared deeply about and were sort of interested in as an extension of the natural world. And certainly Keats, who's a Romantic, was also a doctor, so he also knew what it was like to have one's hands and an abdomen, too, so there was a grounding to his work. But obviously, this is a different sort of understanding than the metaphysical understanding, and there's a lot, not always, obviously these are huge generalizations, but with the Romantics, there's also a lot of placing of value on nature, you know, like my brother, the sun, who comes through on the whispering, beautiful wind, right? The wind doesn't exist just in and of itself. The poet is saying, oh, it's this beautiful, lovely, gentle thing, right? Assigning lots of different values or qualities to the object, rather than letting the natural object just exist in and of itself. Does that make sense to you? Okay. Then I sort of chose the Imagist movement, which is a branch off of modernism. 1912 to 1917, poets in there, Pound, H.D., Amy Lowell, and these are sort of, Ezra Pound developed these sorts of, his sort of three rules for what makes an Imagist poem, were direct treatment of the thing. They didn't want any of this, like, flowery language. Get rid of that. Just give us the thing itself. Marianne Moore's favorite line about this is no ideas but in things, right? That it's, we don't want the extra words, especially the sort of flowery ones, just the thing. And also, Pound wanted to do away with rhythm as a metronome. So no more of this, like, da-dun, 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 da-dun. Like, he wanted free verse, he wanted the musical sequence of language. So that sort of came in. And an extension sort of this more is really a sort of poetic emphasis just on letting the image itself, just letting the thing itself speak for itself. Like if you describe the thing really, really well without adding in all your own ideas of whether it's beautiful or whether it's ugly, without assigning value to it, if you just talk about it really, really deeply, that's sort of the best and most accurate way to sort of be in contact with the natural world. Does that kind of make sense? So partly as we look at these poems, you know, just keep this in the back of your mind as, you know, are there moments, we're gonna look at Robert Frost's poem, Birches, first. And are there moments where, I think there's moments where he maybe inhabits many of these places. So it's not that we're trying to peg him down to one or another, but just do you see moments where he's sort of inhabiting one of these modes of interaction? Any questions so far? That was a lot. Okay, so let's look at the poem. Okay, as we look at this poem and the next one and sort of throughout the week, the sort of three questions that I kind of want to return to are, as we read this, what is the speaker's relationship to the natural world? It might be different at different points in the poem, that's okay. And once we sort of figure that out, what are the possible repercussions of such a relationship? Good effects, bad effects, etc. And is this the kind of relationship that God calls us into and toward? So for ourselves, is this a good model for ways that we might inhabit the environment? We actually looked at this poem as the eye opener this morning, and I encouraged folks to write down a line that they really, really liked and carry it with them through the day. And we had somebody do a really lovely reading of it this morning. So I'm just wondering if anybody who was there this morning, who has maybe read through this once or twice, would like to read it. Anyone? You will. Fabulous. And is it Wanda?
Wanda. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them, but swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and praises their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once they are bowed, so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods, years afterwards trailing their leaves on the ground, like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by writing them down over and over again, until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp. Not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away. Clear to the ground, he always kept his poise to the top of the branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim, and even above the brim. Then he flung outward feet first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of consideration, and life is too much like a pathless wood, where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs, broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I like to get away from earth for a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away, not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more and it dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches.
So we're gonna go through this again more slowly. And I'd like to sort of look at it in three sections. The first being lines 1 through 20, up until that second but that I was going. And then the second part being lines 21 through 40, and then the third section. So it sort of breaks neatly up into these three different sections, and we'll sort of talk about each section here. Okay, so when I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. What do we know so far? Any observations about this speaker?
Yes. He's observant of trees.
He's observant of trees. Okay. He cares about trees, right? Because he's important to him. Fabulous. What else?
I think he's a dreamer. He doesn't like to think. He doesn't want to think about the natural process of it, but he dreams of, already he dreams of the story of what it could be besides what it actually is.
Great. So already we have these two different realities, what he sees and what he'd sort of like to be seeing, right? Or what he's imagining or what he's projecting backward towards, yeah. Anything else? Those are the important ones, but anybody want to mention anything else before we?
He sees it as a joy or something to play with.
Uh-huh. Yes, what he wants to think of is this sort of joyful, youthful expression.
Choosing that instead of the straight or darker.
Yes.
That are also in his vision.
Yes.
And it could be something that he has done, so he knows how it works.
Yes, and so there's that sort of hint of that, right, that he must have that knowledge, which we'll hear more about later in the poem, but great, there's already that sort of foreshadowing of that. And we get to that. The I like to think, right? So there's this sense of what he wants to think about. And then we get to the big but, right? But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. So what is he setting up here? What sort of, what's distinction is being made?
What he likes to think and what really is.
What he likes to think and what really is, yep. And what two kinds of bending do we have going on?
Well, we have, on the one hand, the ice storms bend it is kind of controlling it and making it stay in that position.
Mm-hmm.
Where it sounds, in his mind, the boy swinging on it doesn't necessarily
keep it.
Yeah.
Yes, and we're going to hear more about that. So the swing doesn't bend them down to stay, as the ice storms do bend them down to stay.
Ah.
Are there, they should be, yeah.
They're right up.
Okay. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen.
What do folks notice about this section?
Is this a beautiful image for you? Is it a, what sort of connotations or emotions does it bring forth?
For me, it makes me think of when I first moved out here,
mm-hmm.
and the first time I saw a crystal thaw, and the ice, and it's like you said, you could see the rainbows
mm-hmm.
in them, and I just thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah. Other people?
Broken glass is usually a beautiful thing.
Okay. So there's like the beauty of it on the one hand, but then we have the shattering and avalanching on snow crust, right? So some of the connotations of some of these words are not so beautiful. What else do you notice?
Well, along with it, more specifically, the language of loss.
Okay,
well,
say more about that.
Of the purity, perhaps, of the clear crystals.
Mm-hmm.
Being then shattered, turned into this, crystal shells.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of remorse or loss being part of this thing.
Great. Other people, anything you say about?
The birch is sort of receding in the background here, and the ice takes the front.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Yes, all of a sudden his focus has moved to watching this ice fall off. And we've got some great, I mean, as we're hearing that, the sort of, that shattering sound, which is loud, he's also got the, you know, many colored cracks, crazes, and then the shed shells shattering, right? That sort of is that shush of the fall to the snow, too, so.
But it seems like it should be, like, when you were reading it, it seemed like, from what was being described and the words being used, that I should feel, like, sad or something, but I don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm just kind of wondering, you know, what's going on there that I, the language, I don't know, there's something about it that doesn't make me feel like, oh, that's really sad.
Yeah, I don't think it has to, I mean, it's certainly a beautiful, I mean, it's a beautiful image, right? So there's,
but
you're saying the overall connotation for you isn't one of sadness or loss. You're observing the beauty of the image, and although there's some words that might have negative connotations, the overall effect for you isn't negative.
Right, but you know, when you see words like shattering, avalanche, and broken glass, dome of heaven had fallen, it just sounds like, you know, you should be like distraught or something.
Yeah.
But you don't really feel that anymore.
Yeah.
What
other people agree? Yes.
I was just thinking that inner dome of heaven had fallen so that you could see.
Oh.
So that's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. But what I liked is often, you must have seen them. Well, actually, no, I've never seen them. But that invitation.
Great.
And then it's like I'm now part of this because he's so specific about sharing that with me because often I must have. And at the end, I feel like I have.
Great. So the you is very invitational there, and then he follows that up by letting you feel like you have seen it, even though initially you feel like you haven't. Jordan?
In a sense, you'd think that the dome of heaven fallen is sort of like you might like to think that.
Yeah.
It's the same way that he would like to think that boys did this. That
right.
The word invited in also is not just observed as human beings who reflect on what we see and put them in our own stories.
Yes. Fabulous. Fabulous. So this difference between what we think and that we're included in the thinking
yeah.
versus
mm-hmm.
what's actually happening, these two different layers.
Yeah.
Great. And we also, I mean, you know, when we get to the end of the poem, we're talking about heaven again. And so this is in some ways his first introduction of heaven in the poem. We get it here and then we get it back again. So it's sort of interesting to know that the first time we see heaven in the poem, it's on the ground in front of us, and then later on it's going to be something that the speaker is climbing up back towards, but it also has those two different, just sort of like what we're talking about, what's actually there and what we'd like to think is there, right? And so two different versions of heaven, too. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break. Though once they are bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. What do you guys think of this section?
Mm-hmm. And now he's back to talking about the branches on the birches.
Okay, so we're back to the birches finally. He's come back. And what's his commentary on them?
That they're tough.
Well,
they bow,
okay.
But they don't break.
Right. Or they seem not to break. Right? And then he describes an image that's them not breaking. But why does he say they seem not to break?
Because they stay bowed rather than coming back.
Okay, so he's, and I don't know how many people just out walking around the village or somewhere in your life have you seen this sort of effect on trees where an avalanche has come or winter weather has pulled them down, and so now when you go out walking, you see, has everybody seen this? Yeah. And there's great places because of all these avalanches this winter around the village where you really can see this now, right? So we have this sense of these sorts of trees never righting themselves. And they're not broken. officially, right? But he's saying they seem not to break. Mm-hmm. So at some level, is that sort of always remaining bent over in that posture a kind of breaking?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, say why. Why do you think?
Because the natural, the way it was created, was to be upright,
okay.
Which is a sense of a well tree.
Uh-huh.
And if it's not well, it the opposite to me would be that it is broken.
It's broken.
It's bent.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that it's they never rate themselves. Like it's their fault that they're bent over, and really it was a natural process out of their control that caused them to bend over.
Yeah. But a sort of, that's interesting, sort of blaming it on the trees.
I find it kind of a curious two sets of metaphor or things that come up in my mind. The first part with them bending toward the bracket and not writing themselves again, I picture age I'm looking at, I guess, as a person.
Yeah.
Our aging experience, so we're always kind of bowled over a little bit. We don't necessarily break, but then he has these youthful girls, flipping their hair. It's such a different, it's never really disturbed me to read it, but for some reason tonight I'm hearing these two different images.
Yeah, interesting. So usually the bending we associate with age, and yet the metaphor he's pairing it with is these young girls with their hair, right? I just love the hair thrown over the head, right, to dry in the sun. I just think that's just wanted written that. Badly. I've read a little bit of commentary on this poem, and what one person said, and hadn't occurred to me, so I'm interested in what, if this is what came up for you guys, is that image of the girls on the hands and knees with the hair thrown over is this one of sort of servanthood and being a servant or being subjugated or domesticated or whatever, that it's this bowing over, and so that in some ways, this person seemed to think that it was a sort of negative kind of thing that went, I mean, obviously it's matching the, I'd always viewed it as sort of a like, a beautiful positive thing, but this other person seemed to really, I mean, how did you guys?
I immediately saw my sisters doing this.
Really?
They throw the way they throw the hair over, and then before they would tie it up, something like that.
So positive, not a symbol of.
No.
What they do on their hands and knees?
I mean,
to me, it's really odd. I'm sorry, but I've never seen a girl on her hands and knees throwing her hair over.
Other people want to weigh in. I mean, this is
I thought it was negative, but that's just based on kind of. I felt this entire beginning of the poem just had a lot of vivid sounds or strong, harsh sounds to it, the cracks and everything. And so when we got to this image of girls bending over and their hands and knees on the ground, where heaven just fell to the ground too, it was kind of like, oh man, all hell's broken with this.
Yeah.
And so I didn't see it as positive. I thought, I don't know. Why are girls drying their hair that way?
Yeah, Jack.
I hear him just talking about brute nature. And then you contrast that with his human nature in relation to the bending.
Okay.
And so how nature deals with itself is brutal. It bends and forces bending.
Mm-hmm.
It has its own character, or he later in the next transition he says, when truth broke in.
Yes.
It's that little shift and he even names that. This is truth with a capital T. Whereas he'll talk about himself in a much more humanistic or just a different relationship with nature.
Well, and you bring up a great point because, I mean, the next line there that, I'll ask another question before we totally get into this next section, but I was going to say when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, what that means is that then suddenly we have to go back, right, and think like, oh wait, truth broke in back there. I didn't even realize that. Let's go back and figure out where, right, which is at that first but on line 4, right, that's theoretically the voice of truth breaking it. I mean, so now we have the voice of the speaker the voice of truth, you know, who is offered this whole, first we had the speaker talking about, I just love, you know, a boy swinging on birches. Well, this other voice comes in and says, well, but swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Truth comes in as the voice of, like, let's remember what the ice storms do, right? And then we come back to the speaker and what he should prefer. But it's an interesting mode of sort of making us take pause at that moment in the poem and kind of return to what we've just read, because he doesn't let us know truth is breaking in at the moment when truth is breaking in. He tells us that a lot later. Somebody else had their hand up over here.
I did.
You did.
My thoughts were all positive, because the image that comes to my mind is, you know, a girl who's at the beach and has been swimming and having a great time.
Yeah.
And she comes out and she has this wet hair and she's just exuberant and she just flips over on the sand and letting the sun just bask on her hair. So to me, it was a very lovely
costume. Jody, or is this one?
He's messing with our heads a little bit here.
Uh-huh.
If you go back to 14 or 15, they seem not to go. So once they are bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. That's a really downer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're supposed to be really depressed about
yep.
this. But right away, he says, he's going to fool us now. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground. We're continuing to be depressed about all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not supposed to be. Like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun.
Yep.
So we're looking at these trees. We think maybe we should be depressed, Frost tells us, but
mm-hmm.
we should see the beauty in that
yep.
too, because it's like this lovely young woman.
Well, and you bring up a great point just sort of about Frost in general, which is that, he's a modern poet, but in terms of modernism, most sort of modernist poets were influenced by this whole idea of making things new, right? So they were trying out all these new things like collage in poems or voices coming through or free verse, which Frost said was like playing tennis without a net, right? So, and so a lot of people feel, you know, a lot of people that haven't, or that maybe read Frost very quickly, he can tend to seem like somebody who, amongst all these people making things new, is really kind of stuck in the old school way of doing things, right? This is all in blank verse, we're going nicely along. But if you really start to look, like we are sort of more deeply at this, there's a lot of deep ambiguity here, which was very part of the modern movement, feeling sort of unimpressed and not unimpressed, upset with the world as is, and noticing sort of the disjointedness of the world and ambiguity and sort of irony and things like that. And so sometimes Robert Frost, if read in a certain tone, can be kind of taken as this sort of light, like, wasn't this a nice, right, like The Road Not Taken, right, like, isn't that a nice poem? But as you look at this closer, there's a lot of, well, it seems like he's creating this, but he's actually doing this, and so he is a much more complicated poet than sometimes people, I think, give him credit for. Well, obviously, he's a great poet, so anyway. Yes, Ingrid, please.
One more thing about that ambiguity.
Yes.
He does twice tell us that the trees are not ever going to be upright again mm-hmm. before he introduces the image of the girl bent way down. So inevitably, we got to think, what's this doing with the girl?
Yeah. Is she ever going to be truly an upright human being, too? Mm-hmm. Great. So at this point in the poem, do you have a sense, and Jack sort of started us on this path, of what the speaker's relationship to the natural world is? What do you think? We can just... I just want to sort of check in to see if anybody has any.
It's sort of a palette for human. It's got some reality to
sort of a, the external becomes a sort of reflection of the internal state.
We don't yet know if we think it's good that we do this projection.
Okay.
Or if it leads us to a huge mistake about who we are and what nature is.
And what nature is, too.
Yeah, we don't know.
Okay.
What the meaning is, but we kind of see, he's telling us over and over again, I think even you may see girls bending. But no. But again, you people who always make up stories,
right,
may see those things. We don't know if that's good or bad yet.
Right. Awesome. Anybody want to add? Yeah, Nick.
Kind of seems to me, at least so far, when we get to the later parts, maybe that'll change, but as if he's observing, maybe his experience, what he's talking about now, but is speaking from observations, not from present experience.
From, like, you mean from past observations?
Well, the what he is doing is, uh-huh, is from observations. You know, I like to think some boy has been swinging on them. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's swung on them before, uh-huh, but he thinks that that's what's going on. Yeah, well, it feels as if it's not something that he's, you know, actively out there seeing, or experiencing, but has seen in the past.
So it's a reflection sort of later in life. Like there's,
yeah,
this sense of, I think that's a great point, but there's this sense of sort of distance or reflecting back on sort of how things used to be, kind of. Mm-hmm. Which in some ways is very, in my reading at least, kind of fits in with the romantics in some ways, like especially with Wordsworth, you get a lot of like the nostalgia, memory, you know, the natural world is very related to like the way things used to be when I was a boy, right? Like that sort of feeling. Of course we're going, okay, let me read through the next section of this. Anybody else want to say anything before we move on to the next one?
Well, just that, oh, yeah, he does see the flaws. I mean, he sees it as it,
okay,
is, and he knows it so intimately. It's obvious he's touched them, climbed them, and he can. His description of winter, for the ice storm, is so perfect.
Okay.
And he has experienced it, that he's obviously been in that grove of trees.
So it's not like idealism to,
no,
the point of like nature is perfect and beautiful in every way. There's reality kind of in there too. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. There's reality, but he wants to see the whimsy.
Okay.
Rather than the.
Okay.
He knows that what the reality is, but he also wants to see the more whimsical boy climbing on the tree.
Okay.
He wants to put man in nature.
He wants to put the human in the natural.
Yeah, family. Human in nature.
Okay. Let's see how he does that.
Okay.
Next section. Okay. So, but I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung lip, not one was left for him to conquer. Okay, let's just stop for a moment. What words jump out to you here as being a little bit different than maybe where we just were in terms of his relationship to nature?
Ooh, subdue,
conquer.
Limp.
Limp. He took the stiffness out of them, right? I mean, though that might
not
be positive.
One was left, right?
Not one was left. Yeah. So what do you guys think? I mean, we've finally gotten to the playful boy part, the whimsical part. What do you think? Are we? I mean, what's going on?
Sounds so American.
You know, this idea that there's something wrong and we have to tame it, to populate it, to take it over, whatever, subdue it, conquer it.
And it's so interesting because we pity the boy before he, you know, conquers everything. He's all by himself. He doesn't,
right,
know how to play baseball. Of course he wants to play with trees.
Right.
Know,
well, this is such
separate.
A nice moment.
Yeah,
right?
And then you,
right,
have this language that just ruins that pity for this boy. You know, it's like, wait, no,
has sure put that human right on into nature, but as Jody brought up, I mean, we get this, you know, and, you know, the positive connotations followed immediately by connotations that maybe make us feel a little bit more uncomfortable. Yeah?
Well, he apparently ruined all those trees.
Well, let's find out if he did ruin them, though. If this was, because remember, at the beginning, he's comparing the ice storm bending, right, to the child bending, right? So let's, so we do have this subduing and conquering, which the boy is trying to do. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Now in that section, is this the subduing and conquering boy? Right, is this, yeah, say more as what?
I see it as positive, I can't.
Yeah. Well, it's delicate, right? Gentle, careful. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground.
I was thinking that up to the brim, that's the phrase I had all day. Was
yeah.
And up to the brim and even over the brim was more about, if you see children playing, you know, it's that spring coil of energy. Mm. And that over when you do fill your cup and you can't believe it's still in there,
yeah.
And you're waiting, and it's going to, that moment is potential.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Fraught with that tension,
yeah,
on the top of the glass.
So it just made me think he would prefer that instead of the whole ice thing, he was preferring that it was a boy who subdued the trees.
Mm-hmm.
He was preferring that it would have been. So I didn't read it so much of that the conquering was, the trees were conquered.
Uh-huh.
But he would have preferred it to be someone in play or someone having this experience launching.
Rather than the ice. That's his preference. Okay, yeah, Jack.
Well, I heard some preaching advice. Begin with the end in mind.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to bring up the end.
Yeah.
Because he talks about love.
Okay.
And I would say that he's describing love on earth.
Okay.
With this boy, and his way of even conquering can be thought of as an act of love.
Mm-hmm.
And also this gentle filling up to the brim, the way you climb a tree.
Mm-hmm.
You go up high when you get to the top.
Mm-hmm.
You know it's weaker. And so I think that these are ways or pictures of love.
Okay, so in that sense, we're sort of back to the kind of metaphysical idea of using the tree, this whole tree image, as sort of this extended metaphor for something else, in this case, love. That you could read this whole poem as a sort of development of the concept of the birches as love, or the action of climbing.
And
yes,
I think you can see the first part is very rational, descriptive. He calls it the fact,
mm-hmm,
that breaks in.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me to be somewhat of his rational sense of
okay.
What, how do you live in the world,
okay,
as a way of saying there are things you observe as you live. But then there's ways in which you relate,
mm-hmm,
to the things that you observe. And again, it comes down to this profound sort of exchange between life and a person.
Great. I see it, the whole thing is a young boy having fun and him seeing,
mm-hmm,
in his mind this boy just going out and having a good time. He doesn't, obviously, doesn't have other kids to play with. He doesn't have other things, and to me, it's kind of a joyful thing.
Well, absolutely.
I see it as just as a child, just being a child.
Yep.
And not necessarily trying to conquer it, but just
using it for his playfulness.
Well, certainly the lines about then he flung outward feet first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground is this kind of, right, because he's climbed all the way to the top and now we have this sort of, right, he's leaning the tree over, right, back down to the ground and feeling this, what this would be like, this sort of free fall of kind of ecstasy, right? There's total joy in really imagining that image of what it would be like to be riding the top of this tree sort of to the ground, right? Absolutely. Other people, this section?
So what's the sequence here? In the top of this page, we've got all of his father's trees gone, yeah. Right? He's built them all.
Well, okay, but no, but the point, but does he, when he does this, when he white goes to the top and bends it over,
Yeah. Does
that keep the tree bent down?
Well, in line 30, he's writing them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them.
Okay, so in that case he is.
And not one, but hung limp. Not one was left for him to conquer.
Yeah.
So what's he climbing up on?
Well, they can be maybe kind of loosened up without being totally broken over.
Okay.
Yes. So it's like at the beginning, the first line, I see birches bend to left and right. We're not seeing them all the way down to the ground. We're seeing in front of some other trees, we're seeing them go like this.
Okay.
So maybe that's what they're supposed to be, sort of just the right amount of human interaction.
Of flexibility.
Yeah, just the right amount to kind of loosen them up.
Kind of help them out a little bit. Help
them, yeah. But.
Okay. Well, certainly I think he's, the conquering thing is very negative, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we are, as sort of Dorothy's saying, supposed to see, for the most part, that there's a difference between what the ice storm does and what the boy does. That the ice storm, that it is a permanent, like, there's no way it's coming anywhere back up again. And that with the boy swinging the birches, even if he is adding this sort of flexibility, that there is going to be a return of the tree to kind of an upright position after he lets go, at least somewhat. Though you're absolutely right that certainly the boy is changing the tree via his encounter with it, right? It's not, oh tree, I'm giving you a hug and like going on my way and leaving you as you were, right? Mm-hmm. There's certainly been, he's leaving his mark on the tree.
Yeah, just to expound on that, because I still see it as a kind of a conflict between getting all the stiffness out of them and then learning this balance between either, on one hand, if you launch out too soon,
mm-hmm.
the tree doesn't bend.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take it all the way to the top, that's the other end. You've learned not to do that, mm-hmm. not to bring it all clear down to the ground, clear to the ground. So there's a balance between those two.
Yeah. And figuring out how to do it in a perfect way.
Sorry. I remember learning.
Yeah.
And if you think of it, I think, well, sort of worst case scenario in my opinion, like when you think of it in terms of, like comparing it like to the giving tree,
mm-hmm.
right,
and the relationship between that kid and the tree, this is a pretty egalitarian relationship.
Yeah.
No, I mean,
it's not like, can I have your trunk now, tree?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And to me, like conquering it, it seems that they're not talking about just one tree. And when I read it, I think of it as, well, he got up to the top of this tree, and it worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's going to go and maybe try one that's a little bit higher.
Yeah.
And in that is the way that he's conquering
okay.
the trees, not necessarily conquering them to a point where they're broken,
okay.
but that he just...
It's conquering his own mind. You're more into the benevolent conquering.
Well, I would be too, because it's at play. I mean, think of any teenage boy.
Right.
I mean, conquer would definitely be a word
right.
to describe a teenage boy.
Of course.
Boy. I'm, preteen, whatever.
Yep.
He's just civilizing the trees.
Civilizing the trees, right. Manifest destiny in the trees. Okay. Let's, of course, we're like running out of time already because you guys are so good at this. That, man, smart. Okay, so I'm going to read through all the way to the end and then we'll talk about this ending part. So this is sort of the third section where now there's sort of the revelation, so I was once myself a swinger of birches. birches, right? So even if he's not literally saying it right now, we're seeing the speaker himself as this boy, right? So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open.
Yeah.
I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Okay, there's a lot here.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
Well, you certainly see the harshness when he talks about twig lashing.
Yeah, right? This is a whole, I mean, it's kind of interesting that in the middle of this whole poem about birches, where then he then uses a totally different wood scene as another metaphor for life, right? So we've got the birches in that wood, and then the other wood that's life, that's, you know, the twigs are scraping, and it doesn't seem like such a friendly place. Yeah, what else?
He still wants to go back to it, even
uh-huh.
with the harshness.
Mm-hmm.
There's times when I've said, I wish I could go back when I was a girl and all the fun that I had then instead of all the responsibility that I have now. And that's, to me, that's what he's saying. I would like to go back. I know there was things that weren't as comfortable, the trees slashing across the face and stuff. But despite all of that, I still would like to return to that simpler time, that easier time.
Yeah, it seems very much like it's in fact now, right? At this point in his life, when he's weary of considerations, which is an interesting word in and of itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very loaded in many different directions, you could take that. but the boy time seems to be more of a nostalgic, happy place, right, than the current moment of life that's fraught with the considerations and the dark wood and things like that. Yes. What else? Yeah.
Well, he's doing sort of a going to heaven and coming back to
yes.
earth. What, he's dying and getting buried, or what is that all about? And then all of a sudden, bam, he's got love in the midst of it.
Yes.
Like, is he in love and he's not planning on dying? He wants to stay here. And then he's afraid that he might get snatched away because he's having these thoughts of wanting to go to heaven. Where'd this love come from?
No, I think that's an excellent point, because it seems like the end is just more of a metaphor, right, about when life has brought me down, what would be nice is to be able to, right, get away from earth for a while and take this journey up toward heaven and then be brought back down and then sort of keep going on with life, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yes, then there is this line in there, earth's the right place for love. And that's what Jack was sort of getting at, but every time I read that, it surprises me every time I get to that line, because I didn't think we were talking about love in this poem. And it further confuses me because he says this use of to go. I don't know where it's likely to go better, right? Meaning love. Like, I don't know where love is likely to proceed better. But then when he says to go in the next line, what does he mean? I'd like to go.
Sounds like die.
It sounds like die, but then he claims he doesn't want to die. Don't let anybody misunderstand me and think I want to die. I don't want to die. So then if he's telling us that it's not to die, then what is to
I think it goes back to 48, doesn't it? I'd like to get away.
Right.
From
uh-huh.
the wilds. And then he says, how I'd like to go.
Right,
do you
okay.
mean that getting away?
So getting away?
Like we like to come up here.
Right.
And then, but we really know we've got to be set down.
We have to return.
Into our life, and that's where we need to
oh, that's
exercise
great.
Our love.
So Holden as a place.
Yeah, except
that's
it's
that
a bus
that.
Instead of a tree. That
yeah. But equally as terrifying.
Retreat for a while, retreating uh-huh. away from it for a while, knowing that you're not going to go there forever. You're not, much as I'd like to stay at Holden forever, I know I'm not going to
yep.
be doing
to.
That. But I like the idea of just getting away, not having a lot of things to worry about.
Uh-huh.
And then when I do go back, I'll be ready to start over again.
Ready to start over, yeah.
And, hopefully, things will go well.
Yeah.
I won't get all
into the considerations. Weighted down the considerations and the.
Yeah.
Yeah, but does he actually do it? I mean, he says, I would like to get away from Rick for a while. I would like to go by climbing a birch tree. But does he go do it? Does he do it?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, he's. Well, we know from the earlier lines in that section, so I dream
so maybe,
of going back to thee.
Yeah, so maybe he relates to the bending over of just being stuck there for a while and being mm-hmm. never being able to right himself or
right the tree. Mm-hmm.
He was surely as aware as we all are that there's another dominant image in our culture of a man hanging on a tree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which actually goes back to Bible study this morning when Julia was talking about tree law. I wrote down something. Somewhere I wrote it down.
Mm-hmm.
Who was there?
It was in Deuteronomy.
Yes. For anyone hung on a tree is under God's curse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting in light of this book. Yeah.
Is that his italics?
It is, and that is another great question. What is he trying to, what word do we think goes there that he's trying to make clear is not the word?
Two,
right? That this is an action of moving toward heaven, but not to heaven. And it is interesting to think about what the difference is between two. Two assumes, right, that that is going to be our destination. That's what we want to be. And toward is just a start. Okay, so obviously there's tons more we could say about this last section especially. You guys are so great at this. I do just, and we're not even going to get to the second poem, but you're welcome. You're going to be welcome to take it with you if you want, but I do just want to spend a second here at the end getting back to some of this initial stuff, which is, so what, we've talked about a lot of ambiguity here. We've talked about him being in various different modes here, right? We've seen the tree sort of as conceit or a metaphor. We've seen sort of an idealism and passion for the natural world and almost nostalgia for past times, which is a very sort of romantic mode to be in. And we've seen moments of direct treatment of the thing a little bit. Maybe not as much in this one. We would have seen it more in the next poem. But how would you make sense of this speaker's relationship to the natural world? And is this, what's this relationship like? What's your judgment of the relationship? Is this the kind of relationship we should all try to have with the natural world? Is there a lot of big questions? Anybody want to jump in on any one of them?
It seems like nature is sort of the way to get to heaven, but it's hard. I mean, at the first section of the poem, you have the harsh reality of the athlete bending the trees, and even when he was the one swinging them, face and everything like that, but you kind of have to go through the tortures of the damned in order to get to heaven. You have to go through nature, go through all this hard stuff and see the beauty of it in order to keep moving towards.
So you, in your opinion, the speaker is someone who is able to observe, is able to see things, to see nature in both an idealistic way, but also in this sort of raw way that's necessary in order for you to sort of, for there to be some sort of transcendence almost.
Yeah.
So nature is vehicle for transcendence.
Yeah.
Okay, other people? Do you buy it? Do you think this is about nature? Nature gets you, being in nature is what gets you to God? Were you going to say something? You were doing like the hair thing, so I wasn't sure if that was like
yes, that
a subtle
me.
Raising of
yes,
the hand.
I was playing, which is what I was going to say. I think it's a playing image. I think that his relationship to nature is one of love and play, and you can be gusto, but you have to be careful at some time. So for me, it's a very positive nature is something that we've been given to enjoy and to...
It's our plaything?
It's our plaything, but he's saying be careful. There are sometimes that you need to watch out and to be tender with it as well as use it as something to play with, but to be tender with it.
Okay. Are there dangers in seeing nature as sort of plaything?
Well, I'm very haunted by line 50, which I think says there's a deep danger.
What, read it?
In your life. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. You can get caught up in things that are less than what you could possibly be. And I think that's, I don't quite know how it plays out with the tree imagery, but that line just sits there and says that there's things that you could look back and say that was, I sold out, or I, that there's dangers, you want to think. So maybe he won't find himself stuck in the top of the tree. He's always going to tip over and return to earth. To be snatched away, not to return, would be to somehow dwell in the top of the tree.
So, but do you think ultimately his relationship to nature is primarily metaphorical? I mean, it seems kind of from what you're saying that it's more about the reading into the other lines that give us clarity into what the whole natural image meant in the first place. If we didn't have those lines, would the whole tree thing be working for us? I mean, is our love, is the poem's success dependent upon lines that make sense of what the tree means? Do you know what I'm saying? Kind of?
Well, for me, the strength of it is not so much in the metaphorical relationship with nature as his existential relationship with nature.
Okay.
The things he chooses to do and to love.
Okay. Well, obviously, we've run out of time. If you would like, I have copies of this other poem, which is vastly different. If you would like to take one on your way out, please, please do. Thank you so much, and thank you for shedding new light for me on this poem.